Okay, we're going to have our Bible reading now. That's going to be in Matthew chapter 17, starting at verse 14. And it's on the screen behind as well. So, Matthew 17, beginning at verse 14. When they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. "Lord, have mercy on my son," he said. "He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him." "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me." Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of the boy, and he was healed at that moment. Then the disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, "Why couldn't we drive him out?" He replied, "Because you have so little faith. Truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." When they came together in Galilee, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life." And the disciples were filled with grief. After Jesus and the disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma temple tax came to Peter and asked, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" "Yes, he does," he replied. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon?" he asked. "From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and tax? From their own children or from others?" "From others," Peter replied. "Then the children are exempt," Jesus said to him. "But so that we may not cause offence, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4 drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours." Ask that the Lord will bless that reading to us as we seek to study it later.
We're actually going to be looking at all of chapter 17. I took the liberty of the fact that I was preaching all of chapter 16 and 17 to slightly change the boundaries of what I had initially broken it down by. So it was good that we read from 14 to 27, but you are going to need 1 to 13 as well. I'm not going to read it now because we're going to look at it as we go through, but we're going to do the whole chapter, which... yeah, there's a lot in it, so we'll see. We'll see how we do getting through it. But up to this point, in chapter 16, so in the last couple of weeks, Peter's life has perfectly, I think, resembled a roller coaster before even roller coasters were a thing. So I love roller coasters. The vast majority of the biggest and best ones, they slowly crank you up a hill, right? So you sit in and you get onto the You get up to the uphill climb and it goes tick, 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 or clunk, 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 depending how old on you it is. And it takes you to the top of some kind of ridge or tower or whatever it might be. And the anticipation builds as you go up there. You sat there thinking, how much further has it got to go? I can't see the top. It's still ticking. I can see a lot of people and they're looking very small. And it all kind of builds up as you get there till you get to the pinnacle. And if we're thinking about Peter in the last chapter, that's what's been happening through Matthew's gospel, clunk, 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 all the way up to the point where at the pinnacle, Peter has exclaimed, in answer to Jesus' question, "Who do you say I am?" He said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." That was Matthew 16, verse 16. And that was the pinnacle. And just like a roller coaster, it was followed by a very swift rush down a hill. Right, so the roller coaster does that, ticks to the top. You have a split second or a couple of seconds at the top as the roller coaster crests the hill and then whoosh down the other side, and the adrenaline courses through your body. And if you're an adrenaline junkie like me, that's brilliant. That bit of the roller coaster is brilliant. Sadly for Peter, his roller coaster experience before the roller coaster existed was not a rush of adrenaline down the other side. Maybe it was a rush of adrenaline in the way he spoke to Jesus, because he turns around to Jesus and rebukes him. But the point is, Peter's is a bit more like a car crash. Peter goes from hero, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," to zero. where Jesus, in Matthew 16, 23, says to him, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Peter goes from, "Blessed are you, Peter, son of Jonah, because this has been revealed to you by God," to rebuke. "Get behind me, Satan." Now, we could be tempted, couldn't we, having read that in chapter 16 and worked up to this point, to be a little bit harsh on Peter. We go, "Man, Peter, what are you doing, mate?" But we've got to remember, Peter is and was a fallible human being. Yes, he'd been with Jesus for a long time. Yes, he'd seen some stunning stuff. But he also lived in a world where the religious leaders were hostile to Jesus, where the general public was maybe a bit apathetic to Jesus, but at least misunderstood who he was, and where actually, if they did have a concept of the Messiah in their minds, they were misguided in what it should look like. So Peter lives in a context, in a culture, that wasn't exactly all pro-Jesus. And so he makes the declaration, which is brilliant, revealed to him by God, and then he makes his mistake. So actually with Peter, maybe rather than thinking, "Peter, what a numpty," we should probably be thinking, "Ah, Peter, there's a great example of what it looks like to live in the world with the joys and the struggles of knowing who Jesus is, but then getting some of it wrong." Because we live in a world like that, right? It might not be the same groups of people that are hostile or apathetic to Jesus, but we live in a world where some people are hostile to Jesus, and where some people are apathetic to Jesus, they couldn't care less, and some people just misunderstand who God is and what he's like altogether. We also live in a world where there are distortions of the truth that are taught, sometimes from outside the church and sometimes from inside the church. So in that kind of context, we struggle, like Peter, don't we, to get it right. We struggle to believe at times. We live in a fallen and broken world, living with indwelling sin in us, and we struggle, don't we? We struggle with doubts. We maybe doubt God. We maybe doubt what his character is like. We maybe doubt the gospel. Sometimes maybe we struggle with what the Bible teaches on any given subject. Maybe we question whether the whole thing is real every so often. Do I really believe it? Is it really true? Does it really work? If you've never had any of those questions, I think you're either in denial or there's something wrong with your head. Because in reality, every Christian who has ever lived at some point will ask or doubt or have some kind of question over something or other. Something will happen in life that makes them question whether what they know about God is true. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We aren't perfect. God doesn't expect us to get it right all the time. He knows that we are sinful people who need his grace. And so this section in chapter 17, I think, is a good news section for us. It's good news if we have struggled with doubt. It is good news if our faith feels like it's faltering. It is good news as we live in a world that is both apathetic and hostile to the gospel. Because the way Jesus treats not only Peter in that previous section and in this section, but also the rest of the disciples, should encourage us and comfort us. The things that we need to do in response to him as well are not complicated. Jesus doesn't give a really complicated list of what do we need to do in response when we struggle. It's very straightforward, I think. So, chapter 17, we find Peter, but with this time with James and John, and just the three of them are on the way up a mountain with Jesus. And what happens there in verses 1 to 13 is nothing short of glorious. In the true and fullest sense of the word, glorious. So look at verses 1 to 3. Peter, James and John are going up the hill. Jesus leads them up a high mountain by themselves. Verse 2, that's Jesus, transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. Just then, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. So they've gone up a hill, they get to the top, and Jesus' face becomes radiant, and his clothes shine bright white right before their eyes. And then, if that wasn't enough, Moses and Elijah also appear standing in front of them. Moses is there at least because he represents the law. Elijah is there at least because he represents the prophets. There are probably a whole other bunch of reasons why it's those two who appear, but that at least gives you some context. Commentators have written all sorts of stuff on it. But it's also one thing that's worth noting about Moses and Elijah as a little bit of an aside is this. The appearance of Moses and Elijah on that hill with Jesus at least says there's life after death. Because Moses and Elijah are both dead. And yet they stand before Peter, James and John and Jesus alive, talking to him. We don't know what they said, but they talked with Jesus. So when we breathe our last, it's not that we simply cease to exist. The world might tell us that when you die and you're buried 6 feet under or your ashes are scattered wherever it might be, that's it, that's the end. It's not. The Bible makes it very clear that there is life after death. But the focus of these verses and our focus needs to be on Jesus. Look at what happens to him. Jesus shines like the sun. And he shines like the sun because he is, as Peter just declared a few verses earlier, the Son of the living God. He is the glorious, eternal Son of God in human flesh. Jesus is the one who the law, represented by Moses, and the prophets, represented by Elijah, all points forward towards. Jesus here is the promises fulfilled, the promises given to Moses, the promises repeated throughout the Old Testament. Everything that those two men, Moses and Elijah, represent was all pointing towards Jesus. And here is Jesus meeting with them, but as he does, he is transfigured. He shines like the sun. His clothes become bright white. It is a stunning scene. I mean, you can't really imagine it, can you? It is an unbelievable glimpse of God's glory. Just for Peter, James and John. Peter refers back to this in his second letter, and he writes about Jesus these words: "We were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And I imagine as he penned those words, as he was writing that letter to the church, this was what was in his mind. That glorious moment where Jesus, on top of the mountain here, is transfigured. Now think about it. How much of an encouragement would this be to those three men? Because their expectation of the coming all-conquering Messiah had been popped like a balloon with a pin, hadn't it? They've been saying, we want the Messiah to come, we believe Jesus is him and he is going to come and he's going to kick out the Romans. And Jesus says, no, I'm going to come and I'm going to die on a cross. And they go, what? But here, as they stand on the mountaintop with Jesus, they see a glimpse of the all-conquering Messiah. They see a glimpse of the great, glorious Son of God. They get a glimpse of his majesty. It's almost a very gracious pointer, isn't it, from God to these men. Look, he really is the Messiah. It might not be going to pan out the way you thought it was going to pan out, but look, he really is the glorious Son of God. He really is the Messiah you are waiting for, hoping for, and longing for. It's just that glory you were expecting now is for the future. But it is coming, and it's going to be bigger and better than you could possibly imagine. So Peter is then unsurprisingly overcome by it all. And he says, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Why he says that and what significance there is to it is debatable. But what comes next is the thing that is absolutely essential to the whole of this moment, the transfiguration as a thing. If it wasn't already amazing enough, the bright cloud covers them, which would have reminded them of the stories of the Shekinah glory filling the temple when it was dedicated. And out of that cloud, a voice speaks. And the voice speaks and says, this is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. So we've already heard the first bit, right? Jesus' baptism back in Matthew chapter 3. This is my son whom I love. With him I'm well pleased. But this time, not only are they reminded that, look, this really is the Son of God, this is the Father speaking to you, they are then told to listen. That's the key difference here, isn't it? Between the baptism and the transfiguration is that God the Father speaks from heaven and says to the disciples, listen to Jesus. After Peter's rebuke by Jesus, that's massively important, isn't it? Listen to Jesus. Don't question him, Peter. Listen to him. Listen to what he says. He knows what he's talking about. He is my son, with whom I'm well pleased. He's perfect. Listen to him. Do what he says. That, in many senses, is the biggest lesson I think we're supposed to take away from this. Here is Jesus, the glorious Son of God. We know who he is. We know what he's come to do. What have we got to do then? Well, yes, we praise, we worship him, all those kind of things. But the instruction from the Father to the disciples, and I think the instruction to us today, is to listen to him. Where are we getting our guidance for living from? Where do we get our truth from? Who is it that is shaping our responses to the moral and ethical questions that are raised in our day? Who is telling us what is right and what is wrong? Who decides that? Is it the media? Is it the government? Is it the loudest minority? Or is it God? See, our society is a mixture, isn't it, of apathy and hostility towards God, towards God's word, towards the gospel message. So the simple instruction here is massively profound. Listen to Jesus. Listen to the Son of God. Listen to the one whom the Father is perfectly pleased with. He has the authority over and above every person who has ever walked the planet, and even all of those put together. Jesus has the authority. He is the truth. He speaks the truth. All Christian teaching, whoever it is by, is only as good as it leads its hearers to Christ. J.C. Ryle, on his commentary on Matthew's Gospel, says this: the sum and substance of saving religion is to hear Christ. Simple, isn't it? But it's a simple message here. Listen to him. Here he is, the glorious Son of God. You've now seen a glimpse of his glory. Listen to what he says. That's the message for us as Christians, but it's also the message, actually, if you're not a Christian tonight, if you've not turned from Jesus, turned from sin and trusted in Jesus for forgiveness of your sins, the answer is listen to Jesus. Your mates might think you're an idiot, even if you consider Jesus. The way that Jesus has been used by you might only have been an expletive off your lips. The Bible we read about Jesus in might feel old and outdated to you, but God the Father speaks from heaven and says, listen to Jesus. The Father has spoken. God has given us his word, and it tells us to listen to Jesus. And so if you've never given Jesus a fair hearing, what have you got to lose by giving him a chance? If it's nonsense, if it's a whole load of rubbish, you can just rule him out and ignore Christians. You never have to walk into a church again. But if, as we believe here in this church, that Jesus has the words of eternal life, then by listening to Jesus, you could gain more than you could possibly ever imagine. Listen to Jesus. Notice then, as they come down from the mountain, Peter, James and John put this instruction into practice straight away. Jesus says, don't say anything about this until after my resurrection. But rather than, like before, arguing and saying, well, you can't possibly going to be resurrected, Jesus, you're not going to die, they ask a question. They say, well, hold on, let's just work this out. Elijah's supposed to come first, before the Messiah. The religious leaders of the day taught that Elijah would come, would restore all things, and then the Messiah would come. That was the kind of stages and steps of it. What the religious leaders had taught wasn't necessarily wrong, but their timing was wrong. So Elijah was going to come, and Jesus says, Elijah has come, he's John the Baptist. And he did come, and he did prepare the way, but he wasn't going to make all things new. The all things new bit comes after. Elijah has come, now the Messiah has come, and then all things will be made new. The kingdom is here, it is now, but it is not yet. It's begun, it's been set up, but it's not here in its fullness. What you've heard, it's technically not untrue, it's just in the wrong order. And look at their response. They don't go to Jesus, well, hold on a minute, are you sure? They listen and they understand. That's what it says in verse 13. The disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. Yeah, it was a good model for us then, isn't it? In the way that the disciples respond to Jesus' words after that instruction. When something comes up, when we experience something or read something in the Word of God that we struggle with, asking questions is not a bad thing. We can talk to God about it, but we can also talk to brothers and sisters in Christ about it and wrestle through it with them. That is a good thing to do, rather than thinking, oh, do I dare voice that I've got a question about this because I don't understand it or I doubt that it could be true? I think sometimes we feel like that. I dare not express any kind of doubt because somebody will go, oh, maybe you're not really a Christian. But actually, I think asking questions is a good thing to do. We need to be better at it. We need to be more willing to be honest with our doubts, because the reality is we've all got them and had them at some point in time. We need to be willing to ask our questions. Our church as a whole needs to be a place where it is normal to ask questions, to seek further understanding, and where the response to that question is not shock or disappointment or fear, but that the response is grace and compassion and gentleness. Jesus responds with grace, doesn't he? As they ask that question, he doesn't go, "Oh my goodness, what are you doing?" He doesn't, does he? He responds with grace. He knows their weaknesses. He knows that we don't know everything. He knows they didn't know everything. He knows that we struggle to understand. He knows that we live in a fallen world with many voices shouting contradictory things at us left, right, and center every second of the day. He knows that our circumstances often cloud our vision and keep us from seeing him clearly. He knows and sympathizes with our weaknesses, and yet he is strong when we are weak. To listen to Jesus, be willing to be honest about doubts and struggles and ask questions, but then listen to Jesus again. Now, after the mountaintop experience of mountaintop experiences, Peter, James, and John are both crashing down to earth with a huge bump. So we started the reading earlier, look back at verse 14. They get to the bottom, and when they come to the crowd, a man kneels before Jesus and asks for mercy on his son, because his son is gripped with seizures, suffering greatly, falls into water or into fire, and the disciples, up to this point, have not been able to heal him. The other nine have been faith. While Peter, James, and John have enjoyed this unbelievable experience on top of the mountain, the other nine have been faced with a desperate father with a demon-possessed son, and they've not been able to heal him. Now, maybe the whole situation was just really stressful for them. Maybe they were overwhelmed. Maybe they were panicking. But whatever happened, it's still a problem. It's not been solved. Now, Jesus' response is pretty blunt, isn't it? But we need to understand what he is saying and what he isn't saying. So look down at his words again. "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me." Jesus rebuked the demon, it came out of the boy, and he was healed at that moment. The disciples then came to Jesus in private and said, "Why could we not drive him out?" He replied, "Because you have so little faith. Truly I tell you, if your faith is small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to here,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." So notice a few things. First of all, Jesus instantly heals the boy. We should never gloss over healings of Jesus. We sometimes think, I'm so used to Jesus doing something miraculous, it kind of just washes over us. But instantly, Jesus heals the boy. In other words, any demonic power has no match for Jesus. He speaks and they obey. They don't have a choice. And the lives of the boy and his dad are completely transformed. In an instant, their nightmare is over. Now, also note, Jesus' frustration is justified. His frustration is justified, isn't it? He's right. He is an unbelieving and perverse generation. He's just telling them exactly what is true. The question we're left with is, why could the disciples not do it? Which is the question they ask, isn't it? Why could we not do it, Jesus? And the reason we ask that question is because earlier on in Matthew's gospel, Jesus had sent out the disciples to do what? To preach, to heal, and to drive out demons. And they'd done it. So they'd done it before. But here, they can't. Now, Jesus' answer is really important, and it's really important we get it right. So Jesus says it's because they have little faith. Now, if you read the account in Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 9, you can go away and look this up. Jesus' response to them there about the same incident is recorded as, because this kind can only come out by prayer. Right, so we kind of have to think, okay, how do those two things match up together? Either way, what we've got to notice is it's not the amount or the strength of their faith that matters. Why do I say that? Because Jesus says, you couldn't drive it out because you've got little faith, but his very next words are what? If you have faith as small as a mustard seed. Well, that mustard seed is little, right? He's just said they've got little faith, but if they had faith the size of a mustard seed, they'd be able to do it. You could move this mountain to here. So it can't be about the size of their faith. I think the problem is the translation into English doesn't really help us. When it says they have little faith, what it really is talking about, but it wouldn't read very well, is poor faith. It's about the quality of their faith. In other words, it's about what their faith is in. Maybe because of their past actions, and past successes when Jesus sent them out to preach and to heal, they just presumed, well, we'll be able to do it again. Dead easy. We can do it. We can do it. Maybe they presumed it was like a switch. They could just flick it on and off as they needed, like some kind of magic power. They say the right words and here, presto, it's done. Effectively, a good guess would be, why could they not do it? Because they were trusting in themselves and their own ability rather than in Jesus. And because they were doing that, they failed. Best way to illustrate this, I think I've illustrated like this before, but it's worth repeating again. I think you might know of a better illustration, but here's the one I'm going to go for. If you come to a lake and it has ice on it, you could decide you want to walk across it to the other side, right? Now, if the lake has ice on it that is a millimeter thick, and you step out onto the lake with all the confidence in the world that you can walk over to the other side, what is going to happen? You will sink, because there is no way a millimeter of ice will hold your weight. Whether you're a child or whether you're an adult, whatever you weigh, you're sinking. You're in that freezing cold water. Doesn't matter whether you're Usain Bolt and you can run fast. It doesn't matter whether you're as light on your feet as a Russian ballerina. You aren't getting across that lake. But if the ice is 3 foot thick, it doesn't matter how tentative you are. It doesn't matter how slowly you step out onto it. It doesn't matter how nervous you are as you walk across it. You will get to the other side, no problem, because that ice is going to be there for a long time. Doesn't matter how fast you are or how light on your feet you are. You could jump across it. You could jump across it with a weight on your back and it's still not going to crack. It is about what your faith is in, not how big or strong or confident it is. Their problem was their faith was in the wrong thing, presumably in themselves and their own ability rather than in Jesus. We live in a society, don't we, that tells us we need to just believe in ourselves. Believe in yourself. Have enough confidence in yourself. Be whoever and whatever you want to be, and you can do and have whatever you want to have. And it is very easy for us to subtly take on that kind of thinking without maybe even realizing it. But what we need to do is not have more faith in ourselves, but faith in Jesus. We live in a world where lots of things we face are stressful and overwhelming. We could simply panic, look for instant solutions, just try and solve all the problems ourselves because we don't want to look weak and we don't want to seem like we can't cope. But in a society that turns to everyone and everything except God, we've got to make sure we don't fall into the same trap. It can be hard not to go along with that, can't it? It can be hard not to think, well, look, I've been taught that I can just do it if I've got enough of a mindset to do it, or if I've got enough confidence in myself to do it, I can just do it. Well, it's not true, is it? Again, this story tells us we need to have faith in Jesus. We need to look to him, because faith in him, however small it is, however weak it might be, he says can achieve amazing things. There's no denying what Jesus is saying. If our trust is in him, we can do amazing things. Now, I think we probably, in the church culture that we are in, would like to water down the end of verse 20. Nothing will be impossible for you. If you've got faith as small as a mustard seed, nothing will be impossible for you. And we want to water that down, I think, sometimes because we think, well, hold on a minute. If I go down that line, what I'm saying is, if I've just got enough faith, I can do anything. And if something doesn't happen, it's because my faith is not strong enough. And there are plenty of people who are in churches who will tell you that is the case, but it's not, is it? Because we're not really talking here about Jesus when he says nothing will be impossible for you. He's not talking about just being able to go run out there and go, I'm just going to be Superman. I'm just going to fly. He's not talking about becoming invisible or having super strength. He's not talking about just having faith as small as a mustard seed in him. I mean, you can have a nice flash car and you can have a massive house and you can have all the cash you want. Because that's not the kind of thing that Jesus is thinking about here. That's not the plan and purpose, is it? But what we are talking about is, Jesus is saying, if we trust in him, if we have faith in him, we will be able to navigate, endure, and persevere through the trials and tribulations of life. Things that otherwise would seem impossible. Terminal illness, grief, despair, loss, depression. With faith in Jesus, we are able to get through these things, not because of anything in and of ourselves, but because of Jesus. Doesn't mean they will just disappear instantly either. That's not what he's saying. But we're talking about seeing change in our marriages, seeing transformation in our family, talking about reconciliation of broken relationships, about contentment of our place in society, about our contentment in our relationship status or in our sexuality. We're talking about things like overcoming addiction or breaking the pattern of ingrained sin in our lives. We're talking about growing leaders in the church. We're talking about speaking to hostile neighbors, friends, family members, whoever it might be, about Jesus. With faith in Jesus, we can do that. Those things might seem impossible to us, but in his strength, we are able to do them. Those things can be achieved. If we try and do them on our own, if we try and fix broken relationships on our own, it doesn't usually work, does it? If we try and change somebody else because they need change, you know, we try and change ourselves, usually that doesn't work, does it? But in the Spirit and by Jesus' strength in and through us, we can be transformed. I can't make myself more like Jesus, and neither can you, but he can. Not because of us, because of Jesus. Jesus can change the most stubborn heart. Jesus can change and raise the spiritually dead to life. Jesus can break the strongest powers of darkness. We can't, but he can. And so the call is to have faith in him. However small that faith might be, the call is to have faith in Jesus. We then get the second major prediction of Jesus' death and resurrection. And this time again, the disciples, they don't understand it all yet, but they're learning because they listen and they take it on board. And then the final section probably feels a little bit detached, and maybe it probably should stand alone as a different sermon or something else, but I think it's worth us looking at it. Having thought about listening to Jesus and having thought about having faith in Jesus, actually, in one sense, this is one outworking of that. So Jesus says to the disciples, so the question about temple tax and whether Jesus pays it or doesn't pay it, and again, there's a couple of miraculous moments in there, isn't there? Jesus speaks first when Peter comes into the house. Jesus wasn't there when they asked Peter the question, but Jesus knows what they've asked. And so he says to Peter, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect their duty and taxes? From their children or from others?" So Jesus has knowledge of what's going on. He's not part of the conversation. He speaks first. And then the last bit's miraculous too, isn't it? Jesus says, "Right, so we don't cause offence. Get your fishing rod, Peter. Have a quick wander out of the lake. Cast it in. The first fish you catch, open its gob and there'll be a 2-drachma coin in it. Go and pay the temple tax." I mean, at this point, Peter's probably thinking, okay, fair enough, because he's seen plenty of it. But it's mad, isn't it? If I tell you, just go up to those fishing lakes, you know, out near Carlton, toss it in. The first fish you catch, you open its mouth, there'll be a £2 coin in there. You think, Matt, you're nuts. Right? You would. You think I was mad. But the point of the story seems to be this. The logic of Jesus in his question is, children of God don't need to pay the temple tax. It belongs to God. There is, you don't tax your kids, do you? That's, he says, the people who demand taxes, they don't tax their children, they tax their, you know, the people they're over. So I think the call in these verses is this. I think it comes in Jesus' words when he says, "So that we might not cause offense." I think the cause is to be here for us to be good citizens. We are children of God and we don't belong to this world. We are simply passing through, waiting for our eternal home. But while we still live and walk on this planet, we should do what we're called to do by those in authority. As long as it doesn't cause us to sin, we should be submissive, good citizens in society. We shouldn't be looking to be controversial or looking to cause offence. Again, J.C. Ryle helpfully challenges us to ask whether, as either citizens of a nation or members of a church or members of a society, this question: will it do any good to the cause of religion to resist the powers that be? It's a really good question, isn't it, to ask? When we think, should I resist this? Should I stand against this thing or that thing that the government says or doing? Actually, is it going to promote the cause of Christ? Is it going to promote the gospel? Is it going to do good for Christianity or for Christians or for society? And that, is it going to do that if I stand against it? If the answer is doubtful or it's definitely a no, then don't bother. Don't cause offence for the sake of causing offence. Don't kick up a fuss for the sake of kicking up a fuss. It's not worth it. Or, he says, on the flip side, do the principles or measures that are put in place that are coming to you, do those things injure your soul, he says. other words, are they going to cause you to sin? Are they going to cause you to walk away from Jesus or something like that? If the answer is yes, well, then do stand up against it. But if the answer to both those questions is no, then we should simply seek to live at peace and not cause offence. We should suffer the frustrations that we might feel personally for the sake of the gospel. Ultimately then, headlines, if you want to take a couple of things away, is this. The big one is listen to Jesus. Listen to Jesus. Look who he is. Look at the fact that he is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, the glorious one, and listen to him. And don't just listen to his words, be obedient to them. Listen and do it. And then as you live life, it is living life by faith in Jesus. That is the only way to live the Christian life. To live by faith in Jesus, however strong or weak or shaky that faith may be day by day, live by faith in Jesus. And if we do those things, if we listen to Jesus and live by faith in Jesus, we'll actually be good citizens. So that last one will be quite easy. Listen to Jesus, live by faith in Jesus.